Hey, what's going on, everybody? It's Mr. Lutz, and we're back again. Another episode of World History Class with Mr. Lutz. And in episode 11 today, we are going to be getting into the Byzantine Empire. So, yeah, we're going to pick up with the fall of the Western Roman Empire and head east to the city of Constantinople, which is the heart of the Byzantine Empire. And our story is going to begin with the reign of Emperor Justinian. We're going to dive into Byzantine society and politics. Going to investigate the cultural and religious traditions of the Byzantines and understand how their influences spread into the lands of Kievan Rus before the Byzantines will end up collapsing at the hands of the Ottoman Turks by 1453. So before we dig in, I think it's really important for us to pause and consider the geography of the Byzantine Empire. Its capital city, Constantinople, is situated on this body of water called the Bosporus Strait. Historically, super important body of water because what it does is it takes the Black Sea in the north and it links it through another strait called the Dardanelles into the Mediterranean to the south. And so ultimately, it's going to be not only a link for this north-south route, but because of where it is in proximity at the edge of Europe leaning into Asia, it's going to be the link between the lands of the Roman Empire and the riches and the materials that they desire that are located much further to the east. So when Constantine moves the capital to this eastward location, this city is going to become the intellectual heart, the cultural heart of the old Roman Empire, and it's going to be home to libraries, marvelous palaces, churches, a hippodrome that's going to be able to house up to 100,000 spectators. And that's something that we're going to tackle here throughout this episode. You'll hear about that hippodrome again, trust me. All right, so for the key concept connections in this episode, this chapter, it really hits on a lot of them. I'm going to run through, I think, four major ones that I think it really gets to, and I'll have a little bit more to say about the key concepts in general before we start knocking them down throughout this episode. So the first one is going to be 3.1.1, and it says that improved transportation technologies and commercial practices led to an increased volume of trade and expand the geographical range of existing and newly active trade networks. Second one is 3.1.2, which I think is an even bigger one in this episode, and that's the idea that the movement of peoples caused environmental and linguistic effects. We'll also talk about 3.2.1, and that's that empires collapsed and were reconstituted. In some regions, new state forms emerged, talking about the politics there, which we'll get heavily into. And then finally, I think we'll touch a bit on 3.3.2, which is that the fate of cities varied greatly, with periods of significant decline and with periods of increased urbanization buoyed by rising productivity and expanding trade networks. So you have to understand that some of these key concepts are working hand in hand as you read the chapter. Like, for example, the Eastern Roman Empire is going to have distinct state forms in certain respects. That is compared to like the Western Roman Empire. But in other ways, they're going to be retaining influences thanks to their links to the former Western Roman Empire or Kievan Rus developing new state forms that we'll talk about. But Kievan Rus is under super heavy influence from the Byzantines. So I kind of want to give you a little bit of a chronology here, not naming years and everything, but trying to work our way through this in a historical sense, in a chronological sense, just to make it make a little bit more sense, keep things clear for you. So we'll start with Justinian's achievements, and I think Justinian's achievements best line up with key concept 3.2.1. And going into this, I've got to emphasize, first of all, that emperors of what we call the quote-unquote Byzantine Empire, they still see themselves as the rulers of all of the former Roman Empire, so Eastern and Western. And Justinian sees himself as being no different in that vein. And so Justinian, with the advice of his highly intelligent, highly principled wife, Theodora, someone, again, we'll talk about much later in the episode, and his leading general, Belisarius, they're going to struggle and fight to reclaim North Africa and Italy, including Rome, from various groups, and they're eventually going to succeed. For those of you who see me in class on a personal basis every day, and you look at my door full of memes, you'll notice there's one of them that has Justinian wearing a white hat saying, make the Roman Empire great again. And that's exactly why, because he's trying to restore the Roman Empire back to the way that it was prior to its collapse in the 5th century. So not only does Justinian make this huge effort to reclaim some of these lost parts of the empire, but I think his most significant contribution to future generations is going to be his civil code. Sometimes it gets called the Justinian Code. And what this is going to be, it's the defining legal code for the entirety of the empire. Heavily influenced from older concepts in Rome, but a lot of Roman law wasn't, quote-unquote, like codified. It wasn't written down. And this one is. It's extremely complex. It's an extremely large legal code system, but it helps to regulate life in the realms of like property inheritance and women's rights, and of course, criminal justice in terms of marriage, regulating slavery, and a whole host of other things. So it's really going to have its hands in a lot of the pockets that would kind of define Byzantine society at this time. But not only is Justinian known for expanding the empire for a bit there and refining this legal code, but he's also known for his contributions to making improvements to Constantinople. He's going to order the rebuilding of fortifications. He's going to enlarge his own palace, improve some hospitals, provide public baths, aqueducts, schools, really building up those public services, those public works projects that we've talked about in those older classical empires. But I think his most notable contribution in terms of like what people still see today is a building called the Hagia Sophia. And today it's a mosque, which is completely due to the Ottoman Turks' invasion of Constantinople in 1453. But when Justinian has the Hagia Sophia built, this is considered to be the most significant Christian church in the world upon its construction. It's really cool because the architectural style, looking at it, there's a continuation or a continuity of Roman architectural techniques. And you'll notice that in the dome roof on the exterior. Inside, some of the inlaid designs, they kind of have this vibe of the earlier Roman imperial days. But for all the successes that Justinian experiences, there are some internal struggles, primarily one event called the Nika Riots, which I'll come back to later on. But your book really focuses heavily on his external pressures that he faces. And those gains that he experiences in North Africa and in Italy, they're really difficult to hang on to. And his Western territories, like Italy, they're going to be lost to groups like the Lombards. And not only are those territories going to really be difficult to hold on to, but Byzantine emperors, Justinian and others, are going to continually deal with these raiders on the borders in the north from groups like the Slavs and the Bulgars. In the east, they're constantly dealing with the Sassanid Persian Empire. And eventually, those Arab armies that we've discussed earlier as the 7th century starts to move into the 8th century and that empire expands, oftentimes it's going to be done at the expense of the Byzantine Empire's territory. Constantinople is going to be attacked by groups in 626, 674, 717. Then there's going to be Russians attacking at least three times between the 9th and 11th century CE. Then from there, you have who are supposed to be the allies of the Byzantines, the Western Europeans, primarily the Venetians, invading the city in the 13th century. And then you're dealing with Muslim Turks on top of all of that, of course, finally getting a hold of the city once and for all in 1453. Now, the Byzantines can hold off a lot of these outside threats. They have some advanced technology for their time. I think your book mentions one thing called Greek fire, which it's not known exactly what the ingredients to the substance were, but it is known that this substance could be lit and set fire to even when it was on water. And it really caused nightmares for the people that the Byzantines would have been fighting back then. So against the backdrop of these foreign pressures that the Byzantines are constantly experiencing, I think it's worthwhile to understand the inner workings of the Byzantines as well and talk about their political structures and society at large here. Again, tying into key concept 3.2.1. So the Byzantine emperor is going to be similar to a lot of different emperors and kings that we have talked about and that we will talk about. They're similar in the sense that they are the head of both the church and the state. And they possess the ability to appoint what's called the patriarch of the church, to appoint bishops, to kind of determine what is going to be spoken about in sermons of the clergy. And this blending of both the political and religious authority is something that they're going to call Caesaropapism. I think I got that right. Caesaropapism. And it's a feature of Roman politics since the days of Constantine. So we're going really far back when it comes to Caesaropapism. And these emperors are going to claim their legitimacy, their authority, comes from the blessing of God. So hopefully, as I'm pausing and talking slow in your brains, you're like, hey, that sounds a lot like the Mandate of Heaven. And you'd be right. This is very much like the Chinese concept of the Mandate of Heaven. But I would say it's different in the sense that we can't forget that the religion of the Romans, whether the Western or the Eastern Romans, is going to be dealing with spiritual matters in terms of where do I go when this gig is all over? What comes after that? And although the Chinese would have acknowledged that being a presence to be considered in life, if you remember what we had said about Confucianism, that is not of central importance because, you know, thinkers like Confucius would have argued that is far beyond the realm of human beings to even rationalize and try to imagine. So anyway, cutting back into the Byzantines then, local level. It differs over time, but one of the famous things that is going to be a feature of the Byzantine Empire is something called the theme system. So the Byzantine Empire gets broken into several different provinces or themes, and these themes are going to be controlled by generals of the military who manage both the military affairs and local government administration. And the way that they're able to raise an army on the local level is because they're going to recruit peasants from these local areas and then reward peasants for their military service with grants of land. And that's going to be a really efficient system for the first couple of centuries. I shouldn't say the first couple of centuries. I should say kind of the height of the Byzantine Empire's glory days, which it will say is like the 6th, 7th centuries, to a lesser extent the 8th century. But government officials throughout the empire are going to be appointed rather than elected. The emperor is going to have a senate, but again, that senate is going to be appointed, and that senate serves nothing else in no other kind of capacity other than to be a consultant body to the emperor. And that the Byzantines, one thing that they're known for as well, is going to be their massive bureaucracy. And that bureaucracy is going to be trained in Greek classics like the philosophies and the sciences. And these bureaucrats are absolutely essential on both the imperial level and the local level in terms of legal and tax administration. The Byzantine government's going to get heavily involved in their economy. They're going to draw a significant portion of their wealth in the early days, especially through taxing of foreign trade. They're going to control food prices, and they're going to ensure that prices remain low so that the demands of the rich can be satisfied. So that's kind of our look into Byzantine politics in terms of culture now, moving on to 3.1.1. There's not much to say about Byzantine culture that is super unique in and of itself. And there's a couple of different reasons for that. First of all, their service as a crossroads of trade helps get them to bring influence from a range of places, and it develops into a highly urbanized society. Constantinople, just like Rome before it, has loads of palaces and, like we mentioned before, public baths. There's restaurants to serve its citizens, athletic venues, like I had mentioned earlier with the Hippodrome, and Byzantine art. It's very conservative at its heart, and it's really going to draw heavily upon religious themes, and it was especially known for its work that it had done in mosaics. So with the cultural life as well, I think that's a good avenue for us to delve into the split that emerges between the Eastern Roman Empire and then the lands of the former Western Roman Empire. So I think we're going to get into 3.1.2 here. And of course, it goes without saying, both the Eastern Roman Empire and the remnants of the Western Roman Empire, they inherit a culture, a religion, and a social and political hierarchy of Christianity, thanks to being the lands that kind of where the Roman Empire had once existed, the Western Roman Empire, that is. Christianity had, by the time of the Eastern Roman Empire's height, had reached significant influence all throughout the empire. But the thing of the matter is that the religion had developed differently in the two realms of Europe, with Western Europe kind of still tying itself to the Pope, and Eastern Europe, or the Eastern Roman Empire, tying itself to the Byzantine Emperor and the Patriarch of the Church. And as a result of this differences in development, it's going to start to fracture over disagreements regarding church doctrine, regarding ritual, who has authority over the faith, and things like that. And some of them are like really, I don't want to say trivial, but I mean, they kind of are in terms of like how much facial hair should our members of the clergy have. Hot topic of debate back in the day, like you would not believe. But anyway, after Rome falls, the church is the essential factor of importance in the West, because there's times where state authority isn't as consistent as it could be, or isn't as consistent as it was, let's say. So it's going to be up to clergy to help continue providing services for the members of the faith. And those services could be spiritual services, they could be social services. There's a whole range of things there. And so at the head of all that is the Pope. And eventually, though, the tensions between the Pope in the West and the Byzantine Emperor began to grow to a point they couldn't reconcile anymore under one faith. Byzantine emperors, like I said before, could appoint the Patriarch of the Church, and they could influence what the Eastern Church was to talk about. But these patriarchs, what really grinded their gears was this idea that there was a Pope all the way over in Italy telling them what they should and should not be doing. And these patriarchs resented that, and they wanted theological independence free of the Pope's control. And the Pope has had that control. The office of the Pope, the position of the Pope, has had that control for centuries now. And so the Pope is not willing to surrender that type of power. And so as a result of this, and like I said, lots of other kind of dubious, questionable issues of faith, the Eastern and Western Roman churches are going to decide to finally split in 1054 in what's known as a schism. And it's not going to be this eternally hostile relationship between these two faiths, but they'll never reconcile. And so from that, you're going to get in the East Orthodox Christianity, and in the West, you now have Roman Catholicism. So from there, you know, that's kind of the heart of what I wanted to say about the Byzantine Empire in and of itself. But I did want to talk about the Byzantines' ability to spread their civilization throughout Eastern Europe. So kind of going with 3.1.2 and 3.2.1, like I said, some of these key concepts are overlapping. In the north of the Byzantine territories at this time, and by the way, this time, let's say the 9th century or so, are people known as the Slavs. And in about the 9th century, emerges a group of, it's believed to be Vikings who had migrated from the north and settled in modern-day Russia. And these people were known as the, surprise, surprise, the Rus. So that's where you get Russia from. And as of the 9th century, these people were organized in a tribal sense. They're not unified across this territory, but they do share kind of a similar language of sorts, different dialects, but a similar base language. And during the 9th century, it's at this time that two Christian missionaries from the Byzantine Empire, known as Cyril and Methodius, are going to travel into the region and work to spread Christianity. And in doing so, or in order to do so, I should say, they're going to invent an alphabet. And this alphabet gets known as Cyrillic. And Cyrillic is going to be used to create a version of the Bible that could be read by the Slavs and the Rus in the hopes that they could continue or begin to convert these people of the north to Christianity. So by the 10th century, the largest settlement is going to be along the Dnieper, with a silent D there, I may or may not have had to YouTube how to pronounce that because I had forgotten. You'll never know, I suppose. But anyway, this group, the city that emerges along the Dnieper River is known as Kiev, and it's home to the people there known as the Kievan Rus. This city becomes the most important during this time because of its location along the river, and that river, the Dnieper, I got that pronunciation right, I'm so proud of myself, leads into the Black Sea. And so then through the Black Sea, if you remember my little brief geography lesson at the beginning of the episode, the Black Sea is what connects you to Constantinople, and then out through those two straits, the Bosporus and Dardanelles, that gets you into the Mediterranean. So being on the Dnieper River gets Kiev prime access to the heart of the Byzantine Empire. And so in the 980s, Kiev's Grand Prince Vladimir decides that he wants to adopt a religion to practice, but he's not sure what religion he wants to practice. So he's going to send observers all throughout the empire, the Byzantine Empire that is, and even lands beyond that, to learn about Islam, to learn about Judaism, to learn about Roman Catholicism, and to learn about Orthodox Christianity. And eventually, after these observers had been wowed by the splendor and the faith, perhaps wooed by the fact that alcohol wasn't banned as well. That's always a positive for those Russians, because in Islam, alcohol is going to be banned. Vladimir is going to decide that he and his people would adopt the Eastern Orthodox faith. Now, maybe that there are spiritual reasons for this, but let's not forget the fact that Eastern Orthodox Christianity is also the faith of the Byzantines. So this is going to help the people of Kievan Rus commercially benefit, because now they're going to be able to forge stronger ties with the wealthy Byzantines to the south who have the same religion as them. And Christianity is going to grow throughout Kiev in its heyday in the 11th century, but eventually that state is going to meet its fate at the hands of the Mongols in the 13th century. And we'll get into the Mongols later on, but that Mongol conquest of Kiev and of later on Russia has massive implications, again, which we'll get to later, because there she is. That's my daughter, everyone. That's Evie. This is the first time she made an appearance on the podcast, so shout out to Evie. Glad to hear her on here. So what I was saying was that the Mongols are going to put it very briefly for you for now, they're going to really culturally isolate the Russians for two centuries from Europe, and that's going to have massive implications in a lot of different ways in terms of their economic development, their political development, their cultural development, and even just in the way that Russians see themselves. But I'm not going to get too much into that right now. What I'm also not going to get much into, but it is something that you should think about because I know your book does a good job of this, is just to think more specifically about how the cultural traits that the Rus adopted from the Byzantines, what were those traits exactly? And to make some comparisons here between the Rus and the Byzantines, because I think that that's something good to do, and it's just something to keep this episode to a certain limit I didn't want to really get into here. So before we move out of the key concept connections, the last thing here, the decline of the Byzantine Empire. So going to key concept 3.1.2. Keep this pretty short for you because it's a very long process. It's not just this sudden collapse that there's, you know, a whole rush to try to figure out. It's just a slow decline. And the domestic problems of the Byzantines are going to start to begin in and around the 11th century. We had talked about before that theme system, and there's some problems that start to emerge in the theme system. You start to have land ownership getting consolidated into the hands of the wealthiest landowners, and the peasantry is going to become increasingly dependent on these wealthy few. And less peasants then are going to be receiving land for their military service. So this is going to weaken commitment to the empire, and it's going to decrease tax revenue. And I think on a bigger level, the bigger issue for at the hands of the Byzantines is problems with maintaining empire due to foreign incursions. Starting with Western Europeans, if you remember, they came to fight in the Crusades, or I suppose you actually don't remember because we haven't covered this yet. But Western Europeans come to fight in the Crusades because they're there to protect Christianity and therefore the Eastern Roman Empire. But in doing so, they're going to establish a greater commercial presence in the region, and that's going to suck away some of the commercial power of the Byzantines as well. And then their buddies from Venice end up sacking the city and taking control of it for like almost 60 years as well. I need to research that because I still cannot quite wrap my head around like the blow-by-blow logic of how that came to happen. Anyway, in the east, you have the Seljuk Turks who begin to attack the agricultural heartlands of the Byzantines. And so this is all happening before the Crusades as well, and they're going to defeat them in what's called the Battle of Manzikert in 1071. And so from like the 11th century on, the Byzantines are just holding on to this increasingly shrinking empire, and they remain a shell, and that's really it, of their former past, because they're being surpassed not only militarily, but also economically by their neighbors. And like we've said a few times already, it's going to be 1453 where the Byzantines finally meet their maker in the Ottoman Turks and their conquest of Constantinople. So for the zooming in feature of today, I thought it'd be worthwhile to get into what are called the Nika Riots. It's interesting to me as a soccer fan and seeing in the past in the 80s and the 90s, the hooligans of soccer and stuff. I always look at this event and I kind of get reminded of that. There's not so many direct parallels, but it's just interesting to see where sports and politics kind of overlap. So the Nika Riots. The Nika Riots happen during the reign of Justinian. And it's at a point in his political career where he's become increasingly unpopular due to some of his political policies and especially due to his high taxes and the corruption of government in general. And we had talked about the Hippodrome. And in the Hippodrome, you have these chariot races that go on. And there's two major supporters groups, one called the Blues and one called the Greens. And they have different rooting interests in these chariot races. But more than that, these supporters groups, let's call them because that's what they are, they're also political factions. They're gangs, and they have a lot going on that we're not going to delve into so much here, but they put those differences aside leading into this riot because they're going to unify in their purpose at the Hippodrome during one particular chariot race. And at this particular chariot race, Justinian is in the audience, and they are there to now turn against Justinian and protest his injustices, and they start shouting the word Nika at him. And Nika could be translated into win. So this could be a word you use to yell at the favorite charioteer of yours, you're yelling like Nika, 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 hoping that they win this race. But it also could be translated as being like conquer. And so thousands of people at the Hippodrome kind of turn at Justinian and start yelling this word Nika at him. And it sends Justinian into a panic. And he's going to flee the Hippodrome and head back to his palace. And this mob really wants to bring down Justinian. They're going to set fire to parts of the city, including the Hagia Sophia, including parts of the palace quarters. And they're going to demand the elimination of corrupt officials and legal codes that worked against the masses. And they even start to demand a new emperor. And Justinian is just about ready to flee Constantinople. And it's going to be his wife, Theodora, who basically tells him to, like, man up, do something about this, do not go running away with your tail in between your legs. And he ends up doing that. So he's going to summon his favorite general, Belisarius, and some others, as well as their personal legions, to defend the emperor and the city from the rioters. And these generals and their legions are going to massacre, and I really do truly mean massacre, these rioters in the Hippodrome, ultimately probably killing about 30,000 people and bringing a bloody end to the turmoil. And I think that that just illustrates to you the absolute nature of the emperor's power in the Byzantine Empire, that they're willing to resort to that kind of violence in order to maintain power. Quick suggestion for you in today's version of the explainer. I just think it's a good idea as you approach this chapter to look at it in two ways in terms of the historical reasoning skills that we use in this class. And the first thing would be to consider the change in continuity over time. There's two ways to do that. you could look at how it's changed since the days of the Western Roman Empire prior to its collapse. But I think what's probably smarter is to consider how the Byzantine Empire evolves from the days of Justinian to what it looks like in the days of the Crusades and in the days when they're dealing with the Seljuk Turks and as it's starting to collapse, going, you know, like we said, from the 11th to the 15th centuries. But you could also look at it in terms of compare and contrast. And my suggestion for this would just be take some notes on the characteristics of the Byzantines in terms of the political, the economic, the cultural, and social features. And then as you go and read the next chapter, or as you go and read about Western Europe, you can use what you've got about the Byzantines to make some direct comparisons between them and Western Europe. And again, I just think doing stuff like that, thinking in terms of changing continuity over time, thinking comparatively, it keeps you from having to feel like this is just a big exhaustive list of memorization. Because at the end of the day, I want you thinking historically. You know, I don't need you memorizing all the details about the Byzantine Empire. I want you using that information to draw some historical conclusions here. So lastly, my recommendation for today would be to, if you're not reading this book already, use Traditions and Encounters, chapter 16 in particular, as a way to review the current chapter that you're reading and the next one on Western Europe. I think it just kind of takes the categorical features that we use in AP World History and looks at the Byzantines and Western Europe very, very directly and makes some great comparisons between the two. So if you've got some time to skim through that, I would highly recommend that you do that. But other than that, I think that that's all I've got for you. Of course, there's more that could be said, but I think that that gives you a good setup as to what defines the Byzantine Empire. So until next time, I hope all is well with you, and I hope all is going well in the world of AP World History and in the world of your life. Take care, everyone.